When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Pakistan Cricket Podcast. Episode 6, England's T20I Series in Pakistan. I had the pleasure of interviewing Matt Roller alongside my co-host Alvina Ahmed. Matt writes for ESPN Cricinfo and recently won the Young Journalist of the Year award by the ECB. Should be recording. Okay, so I'm pleased to welcome Matt Roller from ESPN Cricinfo to the show. Now, I was planning on introducing you, Matt, to my co-host today, Alvina Ahmed, but apparently you two have already met in person, which I'm very jealous about, in Karachi. Alvina, is that correct?
Yeah, we met at the team hotel. I actually saw him sitting in the lounge and I was like, if that's Matt Roller, I'm not going back without meeting him. But he was super nice about it and I was too stunned to actually have a proper better conversation. I'm still stunned, actually, that I got to meet him. It's a memorable day for me. It ended well as well with the Pakistan win. It's a great day for me.
Well, hopefully we can, have a better chat about T20 cricket now. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Yeah. So I think, not to embarrass you, Matt, but I think you're rightly considered to be, an expert when it comes to writing about T20 cricket. And you take your stats analysis seriously, obviously, as any T20 expert should. I'm curious how you prepared for this tour in terms of trying to figure out how Pakistan plays, as well as what to expect from the pitches, because obviously you cover England specifically, right, in general.
Well, good question, first of all. And I should say also, thanks very much for having me and reaching out to me. I think for this tour, I mean, actually, to be honest, my main preparation was to spend a week off because it's been such a busy English summer that I needed to skip the Oval test at the end of the summer to get myself in the right headspace to come away for a few weeks and spend a lot of time around cricket, because I think especially, coming from England where cricket's, it's by no means a fringe sport, but it's nowhere near as big as football back mm-hmm. home. It mm-hmm. very much feels like it, especially when you're sort of in team hotels and very much going from hotel to ground a lot of the time. I've tried my best to see a bit of Karachi as well and hopefully do the same in Lahore. But I think it can be quite difficult to get away from the game. So I did take a bit of time off, is the first admission. In terms of Pakistan specifically and the team, so I covered the T20 World Cup last year and also covered Pakistan in England when they played a T20 series, I think it was last summer, so 2021 summer.
That's right, yeah.
And they won at Trent, they beat England at Trent Bridge, and then I think they lost the last two. And also, I'm an unashamed cricket nerd, so I have spent far too much of my life sort of flicking through channels and landing on PSL mid-afternoon in sort of February, March, and ending up watching games there. So
hell yeah.
I felt like I had a little bit of an idea as to what to expect. especially sort of from the two venues, the main thing that I picked up was firstly that Karachi was going to be some quite high scores, even though, you know, the pitch, for example, the pitch last night, so that's Sunday night, depending on when people are listening, that the thrilling three-run Pakistan win, that looked very cracked. And if I'd seen that most places in the world, I would have expected a real low-scoring game. But I think even last night, you know, it was, it did skid through low a bit, but it was still a sort of 160-170 type pitch.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing seems to have been said in terms of the venues was that Karachi would be skiddy lower bounce, tough place to bat against the quicks. People sort of bang it in back of a length and it's still hitting the top of the stumps. And that here in Lahore, there might be a bit more bounce. It might slightly closer replicate conditions in Australia. So yeah, that's sort of the general vibe I picked up over sitting at home watching Bazid and co commentating on PSL games / you know, whatever else I've managed to watch over the time, plus speaking to people in the sort of first few days of the tour before the games got underway. And yeah, then, and in terms of sort of being here more generally, I spoke to, lucky to work with several very good writers at Crick Info who sort of, you know, Osman Samiuddin in the UK is obviously a sort of, you know, one of the great Pakistan cricket writers. And then here in Lahore, we've got Umar Farooq Kalsan and Daniel Rasool as well. So it sort of picked off a little few bits from them about what the country would be like more generally. Obviously, this is the first England tour here in 17 years. So I was, I think, 7 years old last time England were here. So feels a seriously long time ago.
Wow. Yeah.
And I think, yeah, based on that, obviously, you know, it's not necessarily that well trodden a route for people to be coming from the UK. So I think, we've spoken to a couple of players who weren't playing in the PSL. And I think similar to us, they were saying, you know, just because of the fact that, you know, the team have this huge level of security, there are sort of instinctively there's a slight sense of anxiety when you come over somewhere and you think, oh, you know, why do these guys need all these armored vehicles and guns? But I think within mm-hmm. 48 hours or something of being here and actually being able to get out of the hotel, you know, sit in the back of a tuk-tuk and go down to Burns Road in Karachi, walking down to the polo ground, all that sort of stuff, very quickly sort of realized that, you know, there is a reason for it, but it is very much above and beyond. And you know, I feel like I've had a relatively normal life here and haven't been too trapped in hotels and the sort of cricket bubble.
Great. I think Alvina might ask you a question to go into some of the specifics a little bit more later, considering you were in her city. I believe you're in Lahore now. I think Usman Samiuddin, I believe you may have stolen a title or adapted a title from something that Samiuddin, a podcast that Samiuddin used to have. So we might ask you about that later as well, if we have time. Sticking with how Pakistan bat, which, you know, you were answering at the beginning. I know that in your latest piece, you talk about the clash of ideologies or contrast in style between the two teams when it comes to their batting in particular. Could you expand on what you meant by that?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think that the main thing I was sort of trying to get across in that piece, and I'm not 100% sure I did, was basically how much as I think in sort of modern T20, I think there's a general idea from a lot of people that there's a certain way to play and that is sort of the natural endpoint, is that everyone will be playing the same way, where everyone's ultra attacking. You know, the value of cameos is so important. And if players, you know, if you can get a team filled with players who can bat from 1 to 11 who are all striking at 200 plus, then, you know, you're pretty much guaranteed to win every game, you're sorted. Whereas I think actually what increasingly feels the case to me is that there are so many different styles that so many different teams play, and the crucial thing is sort of setting up a template, working out what your strengths are as a side, particularly as a national team. I think working out what your player pool is, because, you know, you, for example, I think in the case of Pakistan, it would be, if Pakistan decided they were going to set up in the way that England do, where they have hitters all the way down, you know, as much as they can, that potentially there would be times where, you know, scores of 180, 190 that they set with the current template turn into 210. There would also be times where that turned into 130 because of the fact that I see it, particularly in the case of Babar and Rizwan, I know we'll come on to them a bit later, and then also with Shahan coming into the team, I think my impression is that he'll probably be sort of listed as number three in the World Cup, and they probably need to be a little bit more flexible than they have been so far in the series about exactly when he comes in. But I think with those guys, if you were to ask them to, you know, try and hit 60 off the power play and don't worry about losing your wicket, I think that would leave Pakistan quite vulnerable to collapses. Whereas with England, I think that the player pool is such that they have so many destructive batters, and their bowling attack has generally been slightly weaker over the past however many years. Whereas I personally would say Pakistan have a pretty strong bowling attack and have done for a while. I think that basically, as I see the series, it's two teams going up against each other who are both playing to their strengths. So I think Pakistan's strength with the bat is that they have two guys who are incredibly consistent run scorers, whether or not they always play with the right intent and whether they always, you know, score as quickly as they could. That's always going to be up for grabs. And I think that's a, you know, I see that as a good thing, that people will be discussing that and people will be working out whether it's the right thing to do. But I think Pakistan, effectively, they with the approach that they play, they have quite a high floor. So it's very unusual for them to be bowled out cheaply. And if that means lowering the ceiling sometimes, then they're sort of thinking, well, so be it. We've got a pretty good bowling attack. We can generally defend scores and we can definitely restrict teams and then chase it, because we've seen how good the chasing team they are. Whereas with England, I think because of the fact that their bowling attack is probably slightly weaker, I think they say, well, look, we're going to take the risk. And sometimes if that means being bowled out for 100, if that means having a few bad days, I think definitely during the home summer, they had a few really bad days and were bowled out pretty cheaply. Then they think, well, look, it's worth us playing our shots, because our strength is attacking batters, playing attacking shots, trying to hit sixes, trying to hit fours. And there will be enough times when we get 200 plus that it's worth the odd 100 all out. And yeah, basically, I think that contrast is a really good thing. I think it would be really boring if everyone tried to play exactly the same way and you didn't have that sort of difference in styles. Like, I definitely think, for example, in football, I've always loved watching Pep Guardiola's teams that he's managed. So, you know, the great Barcelona team back in the day, and then Man City now, even though I don't follow them or support them. But whenever I watch them, and I sort of instinctively want them to do well, because they play, as I see it, beautiful football. But that doesn't mean that that's the only way to play. And if you have a playing pool that doesn't, you know, for example, if you have a brilliant defensive team and no number nine, then that's absolutely fine. If you want to put men behind the ball and try and break up play. So that's quite a sort of long-winded answer, but hopefully it gets into what I'm trying to sort of get across in this series, which is, I think there's a really nice contrast between the team styles. And I think I increasingly don't think there's a sort of quote unquote right way to play T20. I just think that, you know, each team has to be smart about deciding what their method is and picking squads accordingly and sort of doubling down on that.
No, that's great. And that absolutely did come across in the piece you wrote. Just a very quick follow-up. I'm kind of interested in, you know, there's a resource pool, which is, you know, one of the reasons you have to take advantage of resources. Pitches and conditions might matter too. But I also think there's a sort of cultural reset that took place in white ball cricket in England, right? And there's a sort of, and you described very early on that, you know, football is the crazy sport in England, and where it's very reactionary fan bases, you know, if England lose a friendly, the media will go after them, etc., which is very similar to cricket in Pakistan, right? Which makes experimentation or the sort of white ball reset that happened in England much harder, I think, happening in Pakistan. And I wonder if, just very quickly, if you thought you had any thoughts on the idea of the culture and the media landscape affecting T20 strategies.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think, certainly my experience, you know, this summer when we did Jos Buttler's first press interaction before a T20 series in England, I think there was Sky were there, BBC were there, and then there were maybe five written press, and we did a sort of just a quick huddle, 10-minute chat, you know, pretty informal. Then when we arrived here for the first, you know, for the first press conference in Karachi, we were in the ballroom of a hotel, 25 TV cameras, 70-odd journalists, and I was like, wow, okay, right, this is a big deal here. So, yeah, I think that's probably quite telling. I think also my impression, at least, is that while my impression is that while all formats of the game are important in Pakistan, I reckon T20 cricket is probably valued slightly more, and there's probably slightly more media interest and stuff than there is back home. I think it's still back home, especially in this sort of traditional newspaper media, there's a big focus on Test cricket, and with how busy the schedules are, you quite often end up with, you know, chief correspondents might take a series off and give it to their number two during a white ball series. So yeah, there probably has been slightly less heat on England. And yeah, I think Pakistan generally, you know, T20 results have been pretty good over prolonged period of time. And that means that it's always been a case of evolution rather than what England did, which was 2015, basically rip the whole thing up. This doesn't work. Let's work out what we're going to do again. And yeah, obviously it sort of culminated for the 50 over team in the 2019 World Cup, and the T20 team has sort of been a bit up and down, but, you know, a final in 2016 and a semi-final in 2021. So, you know, seems to have paid off so far.
Great. Yeah, that's a good point, actually, about the no need for revolution in a way because of the results being sort of generally steady. So before I let Alvina take over with her questions, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the importance of a quickfire cameo in T20 innings and what a finisher might look like in modern T20 game. I read your, you know, brilliant piece in Cricket Monthly. I think you tweeted about that yesterday after Asif Ali hit two sixes in the three deliveries he got at the end of the innings. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've always been really interested in finishers. I think personally, I've always just been drawn towards players who bat in that role. Like I love Kieran Pollard growing up. I remember being glued to the IPL season in 2019 where Andre Russell was absolutely smoking it at the end. And I've always found it really interesting, the sort of the dynamics of that role. Because I think the most natural thing in T20 cricket is to fear that your best players aren't facing enough balls if they're batting down the order. And that's, you know, that's clearly been the case at times for Pakistan. So Asif last night seems like a pretty obvious example where, you know, he only faces three balls. That's quite often been the case with Asif, where he's not faced the balls that people have often felt he merits. But I suppose that the key thing is that if you are a team that sets up in a particular way, which means that, you know, you keep wickets in hand and often you're going to have a finisher who only comes in and faces a few balls. If someone has specifically trained that set of skills and gears all their work towards hitting sixes at the death, which seems to be the case with Asif Ali. And obviously he's, you know, my impression at least is that he's a player who really has split opinion in Pakistan cricket over a number of years.
Sadly, yes.
He's, you know, and I suppose that the fact is that role is, you know, you're never really going to be hugely consistent in it over a long period of time because it is inherently volatile when you're asked to come in and do something, and asked to hit sixes all the time. So last night, you know, it would have been incredibly possible that he could have holed out to mid wicket for, you know, one off two, and that would have looked like a bad innings. But the impact that innings had was huge. You know, I speak to a couple of guys at CricBiz quite a lot who are a data analytics company. And according to their sort of impact metric, they had which they have basically saying how important was a player's innings for a team's result. I think they had Asif last night was the most impactful Pakistan batter in terms of sort of what he did towards the result. I think they had him slightly, you know, just like 10% more impact on the outcome of the innings than Rizwan, despite the fact that he scored 13 and Rizwan scored 80 odd. I think it's such a key thing. That's the thing. So the temptation is always to then think, well, why doesn't Asif get more balls? He should come in as early as possible. And I think there is a strong case for that. But I think the crucial thing is that Asif's, you know, super strength, I guess, is hitting sixes against seamers at the death. And if you were to then say, right, we need Asif coming in at number three, that is a completely different set of circumstances, a completely different role. It's not something that he's probably as suited to. So for Pakistan, I guess the big question is, how do you sort of manipulate the game situation so that you're, you know, almost losing that wicket at the right time? Because last night it felt like Shan, you know, maybe he shouldn't have come in at number three, but it felt like having come in at number three, they almost needed to lose a wicket slightly earlier than they did, which is a very strange thing to sort of to be discussing. The idea that, you know, it would be a good thing for someone to be out, but it definitely felt like that last night. For Pakistan, the big thing seems to be, for me, is when are they going to, you know, make that call to, you know, who goes in when, basically, especially when they have big opening partnerships. Because the natural thing for me to think is, I look at that innings last night, and I think, I don't think Shan probably should have come in at number three. They could have put Kushtil or Iftikhar or whoever in at number three. And basically, I think they need to be incredibly flexible if they are going to pick Shan and say, if the opening pair bat 12, 14 overs, sorry, mate, you're number eight because we have better guys. You know, everyone else is better suited to that position. And I think Shan being quite an experienced player and a team man and all that sort of thing, I think we'd probably be quite open to that and say, you know, I think he would get it. I don't think my impression of him at least is I don't think he's a selfish guy or anything like that. And I'm sure he would happily slide down the order if that's what it took. So, yeah, hopefully that sort of.
No, that answers it. And also that reminds me that you did an interview with Sean when he went to Derbyshire, I believe. And there's an excellent piece that you did with him. So people should read that. And I think Rehan Al-Haq said something very similar, that Khushdil should have come in where Sean did and Asif should have come in where Khushdil did. Anyway, Alvina, why don't you take over from here? We may have to scrap one of the questions to end on time. But Alvina, why don't you go ahead?
So before I get into the cricket part, I really want to know, how did you like Karachi soup? And did you try the local food here? We're known for our food, by the way. And if there's anything in particular that stood out about the city for you?
I definitely enjoy being in Karachi. I think that the difficulty with it being such a big city is that I knew I was only ever going to be able to scratch the surface. So, you know, hopefully down the line, whenever England, I'm not, sadly not making it back for the test in December. My colleague Bishop Antharaj is coming back, so you can look forward to his content when he's over here. But hopefully, you know, down the line, I'll be able to make it back and sort of get a bit deeper into Karachi life. Food wise, yeah, all brilliant. I think, to be honest, I think because of the fact that we, you know, in there's such a big South Asian diaspora in London in particular, in the UK, that it's pretty second nature, a lot of this stuff for us. So I'm pretty used to like ordering a takeaway, like a dal makhni and a, you know, paneer tikka or whatever it is on a Saturday night. So I was sort of coming over and here and getting the, you know, the better local version of it. But none of it was too surprising, I don't think. But yeah, was treated to some very good food, some good fish as well, which I think was local stuff. So yeah, really enjoyed it. I think in terms of highlights in Karachi, I think one evening just sort of wandering along the beachfront and sort of seeing the sunset and the haze among the city was a really, really cool experience. I loved going to the polo ground on, I think, the first Sunday morning I was there, where there were, I don't know, 500 odd people playing tape ball cricket, which is just, you know, completely beyond the wildest dreams of anyone in England to see an entire park filled with people playing this sport. Loads of cool experiences, I think. It's a city I really enjoy visiting, and I'm hoping that I get a bit of a chance to, yeah, as I say, dip my toe into Lahore, because I think a lot of people, it seems like there's, you know, a sort of friendly rivalry between the two. So but yeah, hopefully I get to enjoy both.
Yeah,
so you've covered the atmosphere in the stadium in your articles as well, but if you could go in a little more depth and share, how was the experience being there in full houses, and the, you know, how do you feel about the passion and craze people have for the game here?
Yeah, I think it was really, really good. I think particularly the Sunday night one, that felt like the sort of loudest, most passionate crowd of the four, to me. I think the series has actually flowed really well, I think, so far in the first four games, because the first night it felt like the main thing was the fact that the game was happening and the occasion and England being back after the late pullout last year, all that sort of thing. I think that was probably the quietest of the four games. And then you obviously had the second night, three incredible moments during that game were, firstly, Dahani taking two wickets and two balls. I think when he bowled Milan around his legs, that was a huge roar. And obviously he goes off in his big celebrations and that sort of thing. Then Baba reaching his 100 and then hitting the winning runs were both incredible noise. Sort of closest thing I can recall to that would probably be sort of stood in a football stadium when a team scores in the Premier League. And then the third game, obviously, I think the atmosphere maybe slightly quieter because Pakistan, it was quite a heavy defeat, but incredibly good to see Harry Brook do as well as he did from an English point of view. Sunday night, I think the crowd was pretty incredible. I think particularly the final, probably even two overs of the, or three overs maybe of the first innings. Obviously the run chase, you know, fluctuates up and down, silence, people leaving, people coming back in to try and celebrate all this stuff. But I think the first innings was that actually probably more than anything showed the, you know, the scale of passion and love for the game and enthusiasm, because you had this, you know, I've obviously seen this debate play out online about Pakistan's batting style and all this stuff, and are they too conservative, do they play enough attacking shots, and then to see, you know, you sort of have the crowd demanding sixes and Sean and Bat and Rizwan at the time sort of not being able to get it off the square and just really sort of scrapping their way around, followed by then the sort of the drama of who's coming out next. The cheers when Masood was out was bizarre, but, you know, kind of made sense. Then people were, I think people were pretty unhappy with the decision of saying Kush still out, was the impression I got at least. And then, the ovation for Asif was incredible as well. You know, someone who's obviously, you know, he's been through a fair amount of hardship in his life. So to sort of hear an entire stadium erupt for him. And then when he, belted those two sixes over mid wicket, I think that whole thing was a pretty cool experience. I'm not 100% whether it was sort of by design or whether we just stumbled across it, but I think four of the five, traveling journalists, we spent most of the time in National Stadium up on the roof. So there's I think on the third level is the press box, and then the fourth level is outside on the roof. So that was great from my point of view, because there's nothing worse, I think, than being behind glass and sort of unable to hear the crowd's reactions to stuff. So we had this incredible view, and also could soak in a bit of atmosphere, which was fantastic. And I think we've been incredibly well looked after so far, and hopefully that continues.
Getting to my next question now, I'm curious to know your thoughts on the horse favorites and in your words, and Karachi's king, I'd like to add, and especially considering the masterclass we just witnessed in the second T20I and his partnership with Rizwan, and if you think Pakistan will be better off by breaking their opening pair going into the T20 World Cup especially.
My instinct is probably not. I don't think it would be a beneficial thing to break up the opening pair. I get the arguments for it. But I think you can sort of underestimate the level of understanding between them. I think there was one line that Bawa came out with after the second game where he said they've basically reached such a good point with their understanding. And you can see this when they run between the wickets. But, you know, at times someone hits a shot and no one needs to call because they both know whether it's one or two, which is kind of incredible level.
Amazing,
of,
yeah.
You know, shows the combination they have. Bawa, I think he's obviously an incredible player to watch, like easy on the eye, all that sort of thing. I think in terms of him as a T20 player, I think he's a very good T20 batter. I would say he's not a great one because of the fact that I think he has certain limitations. So I think he quite often slows down after the power play. I think overall he often plays a role that lends itself to hitting fours and minimizing dot balls rather than hitting sixes. But I think within that certain role, if you're looking for someone who bats through an innings and plays in the way that he plays, I think he's ideal for it. So I suppose it's quite a complicated question in that sense. Obviously he had a difficult time at the Asia Cup, and I think that was an uncharacteristically poor tournament for him. But the impression I get, especially having watched that second match of this series, is that I think it would be foolish to write him off or premature to write him off or anything like that. I think he's clearly a class player. I think the big question for me sort of looking forward is how Pakistan and those two in particular will go in Australia, because it's actually some of Pakistan have played very little T20 cricket. I think they've only played maybe 40 T20 internationals ever in Australia. And obviously not that many of the squad. I know a handful like Harris Ralph have played in Australia in the Big Bash, but not many of them have played their full stop. So I think it will be really interesting to see how they adapt there, because I can sort of see the argument both ways in that, you know, maybe they might be vulnerable against, for example, South Africa's attack, who should be pretty well suited to fast bouncy pitches. But then at the same time, the boundaries are pretty big in Australia, which generally means you're more reliant on minimising dot balls and being busy between the wickets, hitting boundaries rather than, you know, if the square boundaries are 90 metres long or whatever, then it's pretty tough to be regularly clearing them. So, I can see the arguments both ways. But I think, how those two adapt to playing in Australia will probably be the key question in Pakistan's bid to go one or two steps better than they did in Dubai last year.
One last question before we ask you to before we test your Urdu.
Okay, so your article on Harry Brook was brilliant, and you mentioned his scoop shot making him an effective T20I better. So I was wondering, what do you think is the importance of scoop and reverse shots in T20 cricket, and especially at the pace the T20 cricket is developing, do you think it those are the kind of shots all the batters should be working on developing if they wish to excel in this format?
I think you can excel in T20 cricket without having either shot. I think that's true. But I think it does open up a huge amount of space for you as much as anything. So I think, the thing I was sort of trying to get across with Brooke, and I think that the thing that has made him really successful in his T20 career to date is that because of the fact he pays the scoop, that generally means that when he's facing seam bowlers, teams have fine leg back. And obviously, T20 is inherently a game of restrictions. You're only allowed five men out of the ring for 14 overs of it. And if one of those is sort of locked into a particular spot, that means that there are other spaces. And when he's so good over the offside, so he, unlike a lot of sort of modern T20 batters who are all about power hitting, he's very good at lofting over cover and mid off. And that's kind of the trade-off you make, is that, often just because of sort of the nature of setting a field and that sort of thing, if you're putting fine leg back, then that often means you have to bring one of cover or long off inside the ring. Often, it's been both a lot of times for Brooke in this series. So basically it's not so much the shot, and it is a very effective when fine leg is up, and he plays it really well. It's the possibilities that the ability to play the shot opens up. And I think that's similar with the reverse sweep. And I think we've seen that over a number of years now in T20, where, if teams are worried about stopping the reverse sweep, that again opens up other options. So Ben Duckett's actually an interesting one with that. So because, he's a pretty strong player of spin, particularly sweeping and reverse sweeping. And that generally means that teams have men back stopping that gap, and that means that he's actually, he's spoken about working really hard on trying to hit straight down the ground, because that means that teams, because of his strengths, teams always have mid on and mid off up inside the ring rather than back. So that means that he's sort of thinking ahead and saying, well, because of the fact I'm good at this, teams do this, which means that if I do this, I can then counteract this. And it's sort of you're almost playing 4D chess, where you have to be three steps ahead and think, right, what can I do that they're going to do this? When you're planning for a game, you're thinking, they know that I'm good at this, therefore they're going to do this, therefore what can I do to stop the thing that they're going to do because I know this, and so on and so forth. I suppose it's a classic thing of trying to work on weaknesses and make yourself as hard to bowl to as possible. So yeah, I think clearly scooping and reversing is it definitely benefits batters, but I think there's only so much, there's no point in having it playing it if you've not trained pretty hard for it.
All right, the moment you've been dreading before you say goodbye. I see you looking at your phone. I think you're like, were you just checking to see what the words were? Were you cheating there, Matt? I think I saw.
I've got a funny WhatsApp message that my boss was on the 2000 tour here, and I was chatting to him, and he was saying that he was like, he knows like a little bit of Urdu that he picked up then and has sort of kept since then. And apparently someone on the 2000 tour, a journalist on the 2000 tour, was told that the Urdu for thank you is Gambu, which I don't think worked very well for them over the course of however many weeks. I would reckon that pretty early on they worked out that wasn't right.
So knowledge has been passed down in the cricket info halls to yeah, warn the new correct. Journalists going to Pakistan about the stuff that they might encounter. All right, so we know one that you know. Gandu is one you know. What are the other ones, Matt, if you don't mind?
Good question. So obviously... When I tweeted Wood is Wood Yar, which got a bit of pick up on Twitter, as you mentioned, adapting Oz's book. A lot of people, I'm not 100% sure on the sort of context of these two, the most common things you hear people say are achacha, which I think is like, right, right, okay. And then tika. You say shukriya is, I think, the correct version of what people have said before. I'm already scrambling a bit now.
You said you had used some more curse words, Matt. I'm not going to say them, but I'm going to let you say them.
I'm sorry to disappoint. I'm sure I've got them in my back pocket somewhere, but put on the spot. This is like my my year 9 language oral exams all over again. Nightmares flooding back to me.
No more anxiety. Well left at the end. All right, Matt, thank you so much. And thank you so much, Alvina.
Thank you.
Yeah, guys, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Before I finish, I just want to say thank you to Dikobe for letting me use his music. You can donate to my Patreon page if you would like to help me in continuing to do these podcasts. Links with information about the guests, the music, and the Patreon page can be found in the podcast description. Thank you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.